Don't worry, Joe. Want to know where I've been on my sick leave? To Pierre, to my brother Cedric's. He got his training down in Fort Benning, Georgia, and sure knew how to disassemble that rifle. We threw a couple of pieces in the Missouri. I drove back here in a zigzag I can't even remember, down back roads and ditched the rest of it in sloughs. She held up her empty palms and said, "Tell whoever did it to rest easy." Her eyes clouded. Her look gentled. "Your mom, how is she?" "She was out in the garden picking bush beans. She said she was fine, but I mean, she said it over and over so I'd believe her. I'll come see her. I want you to give her this." Linda took something from her pocket and held her fist over my hand. When she opened it, a small black screw fell out. "Tell her she can keep this in her jewelry box, or bury it, whatever she likes." I put the screw in my pocket. Halfway home, blown along all the way back with the usual frozen foil wrapped brick banana bread numb in my armpit, I realized, of course, that the screw in my pocket was part of the rifle. Steadied by the wind, I didn't have to pause or use my handlebars. I fished it out and winged it into the ditch. This time it was Angus's bottle of Captain Jack stolen from his mother's boyfriend, with a handful of Valium pills and a grocery bag halfway filled with cans of cold blats. We were drinking at the edge of the construction site. After the lazy bulldozers and the bobcats stopped moving the same dirt piles around, the place was ours. Some days they left our bike tracks alone. Other days they obliterated our work. We had no idea what was going to be built. There was always the same amount of dirt. "A federal project," said Zack. Cappy tipped the beer down with a pill, lay back, and stared up into the leaves. The light was turning gold. "This here is my favorite time of day," he said. He took a small wallet-sized school photo of Zelia from his cowboy shirt pocket and held it to his forehead.
"Shh. They're communicating," Angus said.
"I miss you too, baby," said Cappy after a few moments. He put the photo back in his pocket, pressed down the pearl snaps, and patted his heart.
"It's beautiful love," I said.
I turned on my side and leaned into the earth and threw up a little. I buried the puke with dirt. Nobody noticed. I mumbled, "I wouldn't mind a beautiful love." Cappy handed me a pamphlet. "Her last letter, man. It was about the rapture. This was in it." Cappy smiled upward. I looked at the pamphlet steadily, reading the words several times to get their meaning.
"Rapture, yeah, man," said Zack.
"Not that kind of rapture," said Cappy. "It's a mass liftoff. There's only a certain number of people who can go. They don't apparently take Catholics, so Zelia's family is thinking of converting before the tribulation. She wants me to convert along with them so we get raptured up together."
"Stairway to heaven," laughed Zack.
"Raptured as one," I said. "As one." My brain had started on a repeating loop, and I had to force my mouth to stop saying everything I thought 50 times. "I don't think you'll make it, you two," said Angus dreamily. "You guys can't get in now with that mortal stain." It was like an icicle jabbed into my thoughts. The subject hadn't come up with the four of us. We hadn't spoken of Lark's death. The cold spread. My brain was clear, but the rest of me was just too comfortable. Cappy handled a moment and melted the fear out of me as usual. "Starboy," said Cappy, holding out his hand. Angus clasped it in a brother shake. "The truth is, none of us will get there. They only take you stone-cold sober."
"All your life?" said Angus.
"All your life," Starboy said, Cappy. "You cannot slip even one time."
"Aw," said Angus, "we're screwed. My whole family's screwed. No rapture."
"We don't need no rapture," Zack said. "We got confession. Tell your sins to Father, and you're wiped clean."
"I did that," said Cappy. "Father tried to clock me."
We all laughed and talked for a while about Cappy's run. Then we fell silent and watched the flickering leaves. "Celia probably confessed at home," Cappy said after a while.
Zelia probably got wiped clean. Unless she got pregnant. I hadn't meant to say a thing like that, but I could not stop the Star Wars quote.
Luke, at that speed, do you think you'll be able to pull out in time?
If only I hadn't, said Cappy. If only she was, we would have to get married then. You're 13, I remembered. Zelia said so were Romeo and Juliet. I hate that movie, said Zack. Angus was asleep, his breath whining evenly as a cicada. Food, my voice again. But the others were sleeping. I stood up after a time because someone was moaning. It was Cappy. He was weeping, heartbroken, then frightened, shouting, please, no, in his sleep. I shook his arm and he passed on to some other dream. I watched over him until he seemed more peaceful. I left them sleeping there and wobbled home on my bike. But when I got into the yard, the space under Pearl's bush looked so comfortable that I crept into the dark leaves with her and slept until the sun faded. I woke up alert and walked in the kitchen door. Joe, where you been? Mom called from the other room. I felt that she had been waiting for me the whole time. I grabbed a glass and poured some milk and drank it fast. Out biking around, I said. You missed dinner. I can warm up some spaghetti. But I was already eating it cold, straight from the refrigerator. Mom came in and shooed me aside. At least you can put it on a plate, Joe. Have you been smoking? You stink like cigarettes. The other guys were. Same old line I gave my folks. I like spaghetti cold. She made me a dish and begged me not to smoke. I won't anymore, I promise. She sat down watching me eat. There's something I wanted to tell you this morning, Joe. You called out in your sleep last night. You yelled. I did? I got up and I went to your door. You were talking to Cappy. What did I say? I couldn't make out what you said, but you called Cappy's name twice. I kept eating. He's my best buddy, Mom. He's like a brother to me. I thought about him crying in his sleep out at the construction site and put my fork down. I wanted to leave our house, find Cappy again. I felt that I should not have left him sleeping. The crack of light beneath my father's door widened, and he came out and sat down at the table with us. He had stopped drinking coffee from dawn till dusk and on into the night. My mother gave him a glass of water. He was neatly shaven, never in his bathrobe anymore. He kept reduced hours at work. I started today, Joe.
Started what?
I was still distracted. If I call Cappy's house, maybe he could get a ride over here and stay the night. We'd be together in the dark. My father kept on talking. I started my walking regimen around the high school track. I made it a half mile. I'll be going every day. You'll be out running, too. I guess you'll lap me a few times. My mother reached out and took his hand. He smoothed his hand over her fingers and touched her wedding ring. She won't let me go alone, he said, looking at her. Oh, Geraldine. They were both thinner, and the lines along the side of their mouths had deepened. But the knife-like mark between my mother's eyebrows was gone now. I had stopped them from living in the fear cloud. I should have felt happy watching them across the table, but instead I was angered by their ignorance. Like I was the grown-up, and the two of them, holding hands, were the oblivious children. They had no idea what I had gone through for them. Or Cappy. Me and Cappy. I stubbed my foot suddenly against the table leg. Something's fighting in me, Joe, my father said. My foot stopped kicking. Maybe you'll understand if I talk to you about it. Okay, I said, though I was jumping out of my skin. I didn't want to listen. I feel relief at Lark's death, my father said. Just like you said when you first heard. I feel that way, too. Your mother is safe from him. He will not show up in the grocery store or at Whitey's. We can go on now, can't we?
Yeah,
I said. I tried to get up, but he spoke.
Yet the question of who killed Lark must be asked. There was no justice for your mother, his victim, or for Mela, and yet justice exists.
Unevenly applied, Dad.
but he got what he deserved.
My voice was flat, my heart sickly pounding. My mother had dropped my father's hand. She did not want to listen to us argue.
I feel that way too, said my father. Birky will interview us tomorrow. It's routine. But nothing is routine. He'll want to know where each of us was when Lark was killed. Here is my fight, Joe. I ask myself in this situation, as one sworn to uphold the law in every case, what I would do if I had any information that could lead to the identity of the killer. Last time I talked to your mother about this, I wasn't sure what I would do.
I looked at Mom, and her lips were pressed together in a straight, dark line.
But I've decided that I would do nothing. I would offer up no information. Any judge knows there are many kinds of justice. For instance, ideal justice as opposed to the best we can do justice, which is what we end up in making so many of our decisions. It was no lynching. There was no question of his guilt. He may have even wanted to get caught and punished. We can't know his mind. Lark's killing is a wrong thing which serves an ideal justice. It settles a legal enigma. It threads that unfair maze of land title law by which Lark could not be prosecuted. His death was the exit. I would say nothing, do nothing, to muddy the resolution. Yet,
my father stopped and tried to give me that old look he used to fix on me, and others, from the bench. I could feel it, but I would not meet his gaze.
Yet, he said gently, this too is an abandonment of my own responsibility. That person who killed Lark will live with the human consequences of having taken a life.
As I did not kill Lark but wanted to, I must at least protect the person who took on that task. And I would, even to the extent of attempting to argue a legal precedent.
What?
Traditional precedent. It could be argued that Lark met the definition of a Wendigo, and that no other recourse. His killing fulfilled the requirements of a very old law.
I felt my mother's attention on me keenly. I just wanted you to know that, my father prodded.
Lots of people had it in for Lark, I said. I looked from one of my parents to the other. Behind them in the next room, the shelves of old books stood mellow in the dip of shadow at twilight. The scuffed brown leather, Meditations, Plato, the Iliad, Shakespeare in sober dark red, and the essays of Montaigne. Then below, a matching great books collection they subscribed to by mail. There was a free book of Mormon from a passing LDS missionary. There was William Warren, Basil Johnston, the narrative of the captivity and adventures of John Tanner, and everything by Vine Deloria, Jr. There were the novels they read together, fat paperbacks thumbed and stacked. I looked at the books as if they could help us. But we had moved way far past books now into the stories Musham told in his sleep. There were no quotations in my father's repertoire for where we were. And it was beyond me at the time to think of Musham's sleep-talking as a reading of traditional case law.
So if you hear anything, Joe, said my father.
If I hear anything, yeah, Dad. He'd gotten my attention. There was some relief for me, even in what he said. But my father was also wrong, and about one thing in particular. He said I was now safe. But I was not exactly safe from Lark, neither was Cappy. Every night he came after us in dreams. We are back at the golf course in the moment I locked eyes with Lark. That terrible contact, then the gunshot. At that moment we exchanged selves. Lark is in my body watching. I am in his body dying. Cappy runs up the hill with Joe and the gun, but he doesn't know Joe contains the soul of Lark. Dying on the golf course. I know that Lark is going to kill Cappy when they reach the overlook. I try to call out and warn Cappy, but I feel my life bleed out of me into the clipped grass. I either have that dream or one where I see the backyard ghost again, the same ghost Randall saw in the sweat lodge, his sour gaze and rigid mouth,
only this time, like with Randall, the ghost is leaning over me, talking to me through a veil of darkness, backlit, his white hair shining. And I know he's the police. As always, I woke shouting Cappy's name. To muffle sound, I stuffed a towel at the base of my door. I peered out in the fresh light, hoping no one had heard me. I listened. It sounded like Mom and Dad had gone downstairs already or gone out. I lay back in the covers. The air was cool, but I was sweating and still full of adrenaline. My heart was jumping. I rubbed my hand on my chest to calm it and tried to slow down my breathing. Each dream was more real every time it occurred, like it was wearing a track into my brain. "I need medicine," I said out loud, meaning Ojibwe medicine. Old-time medicine people knew how to handle dreams. That's what Mushum had said. But his spirit was far away now, trying to shed the body in the cot by the window. The only other medicine person I knew was Grandma Thunder. Maybe we could ask her what to do. Not tell her details, of course, or reveal what had happened. Just get advice about these dreams. Bugger Poirier, of all people, stepped into my thoughts right then. Probably because the last time I thought of Grandma Thunder, I sent him to her. And right before that, Bugger had stolen my bike. Something about a dream. I sat up. He wanted to see if something he saw was a dream. My own dream's reality, which always clung to me, and Bugger's intent, drunken fixation, fused. What had he seen? I had worked on Bugger's hunger and turned him around so I could get back my bicycle, but I never asked him what he saw. I got up and got dressed, ate some breakfast, and went out. To look for Bugger, you look behind places, starting with the dead Custer. I searched all morning and asked everyone I met, but no one knew. I finally went to the post office. That's where I should have gone first, it turned out. I didn't think of it, as poor Bugger hadn't had an address. "He's in the hospital," said Linda. "Isn't he?" She called back to Mrs. Nanapush, sorting letters. "He busted his foot stealing a case of beer. Dropped it on his foot. So now he's laid up, and his sisters say it's blessing in disguise. Could dry him out." I drove over to the hospital to visit Bugger. He was in a room with three other men. His foot was in a cast, rigged for traction, though I wondered if that was necessary for his foot to heal, or meant to tie him to the bed. "My boy!" He was glad to see me. "Did you bring me a drop?" "No," I said. His avid face fell into a pout. "I came to ask you something." "Not even a little flower arrangement," he grumped, "or a pancake?"
"You want a pancake?"
"I've been seeing pancakes, whiskey, spiders, pancakes, lizards. Pancakes are the only good thing I see. But they just feed an old man the damn oatmeal, coffee and oatmeal. It's a plain breakfast."
"Not even toast?" I asked.
"I could have it if I wanted, but I keep asking for pancakes." Bugger looked at me fiercely. "I'm holding up for pancakes."
"I have to ask you something."
"Ask away, then. I'll give you an answer for a pancake."
"Okay."
"And whiskey." He leaned forward secretively. "Bring me a drop, but don't let those others know about it. Keep the bottle in your shirt."
"All right." Bugger sat back, ready, his face expectant. "Remember when you took my bike?" His face turned blank. I spoke slowly, pausing after each sentence for him to nod.
"You were sitting outside Muddy L's. You saw my bike. You got on my bike and started riding. I came out and asked where you were going. You said you wanted to check and see if something was a dream." Bugger's face lighted up. "Remember now?"
"No."
I reset the scene 5 or 6 times before Bugger's mind finally turned back and began to riffle through the recent past. He held very still and concentrated now, so hard I could almost hear the gears grind. As his thoughts collected, his expression changed, but so gradually that it was only after I looked away impatiently and then looked back that I noticed he was petrified.
He stared at something between us on the bed cover. I thought he was having a hallucination, not of the pancakes, which would have filled him with joy, but some sort of reptile or insect. But then his look changed to pity, and he gasped. Poor girl.
What girl?
Poor girl. He began to sob in dry wrenches. He kept crying about her. He mumbled about construction, and I knew. She was in the construction site. The earth mounded over her. I couldn't help the picture from forming. Us jumping, our bikes flying back and forth, and her below. I stood up, jolted. I knew, down to the core of me, that he had seen Mela Wolfskin. He had seen her dead body. If we hadn't killed Lark, he'd have gone to jail for life anyway. I spun around thinking I should go to the police, then stopped. I could not let the police know I was even thinking this way. I had to get off their radar entirely, with Cappy disappear. I couldn't tell anyone. Even I didn't want to know what I knew. The best thing for me to do was forget. And then the rest of my life to try and not think of different things would have gone if, in the first place, I just followed Bugger's dream. I needed to find Cappy. Not to tell him. I never would tell him. I'd never tell anyone. There was in me, as I rode toward the La Fournaise, a disconnect so profound I could think of nothing but obliteration. I would somehow find the means to get drunk. The world would take on that amber tone. Things would soften to brown, as if in old photographs. I would be safe. Zack and Angus were hanging out in the grocery store parking lot. Their bikes were there, and Cappy's too. But they were sitting in Zack's older cousin's car. They got out when they saw me and told me that Cappy had gone into the post office to see if there was a letter. He should have come out by now, said Zack. I went to get Cappy and finally found him out back of the building, sitting on a busted chair where the post office employees took smoke breaks in the summer. His hair was flung down over his face. He was smoking and didn't look at me when I stood next to him, just held out a piece of paper. You will cease and desist from any contact with our daughter. My wife found the package of letters Zelia was hiding. You should have to consider that in this case we may persecute you to the full extent of the law. Also currently, Zelia is being punished, and also in short order we will be changing residence. You have stolen our daughter's innocence and racked our life. Cappy's arms and legs were splayed out, limp and despairing. His face was the color of ashes. There was a cloud of smoke around his head. I sat down beside him on a cardboard box. There was nothing to say about anything at all. I put my head in my hands. Yeah, said Cappy wildly. Fuck yeah, punish her. I bet they're keeping her locked up until they move, so she can't go over to the post office. Racked their lives. I'll rack their lives. By loving their daughter with a true love? Look at me, brother, he begged. I did. Look at me. He threw his hair back, tapped the tips of his fingers on his chest. Would I rack her life? The Creator made us for each other. Me here? Zelia there? Space was put between us by human error. But our hearts listen to divine will. Our bodies, too. So fucking what? Every bit of what we did was made in heaven. The Creator is goodness, brother. In His mysterious mercy, He gave me Zelia. The gift of our love, I can't throw it back in the face of the Creator, can I?
No.
That's what her parents are asking me to do, but I won't do it. I will not throw our love back in God's face. It will exist for all time, whether or not her parents can see that. Nothing they do can get between us.
Okay.
Yeah, said Cappy. His hair flopped down again. He set fire to the letter with the burning coal of his cigarette, watched it catch, flare, and burn to the tip of his fingers. He dropped the scrap and the flimsy films of burnt paper floated down around his feet.
"I'm going home to get that bus money," said Cappy. "And then I'm gassing up Randall's car. I'll come and get you at your house."
"Where are we going?"
"I can't sit still, Joe. I can't stay here. And I know there will be no rest for me until I see her."
We left Zack and Angus drinking pop in Zack's cousin's car, and I went home. My place was empty. I filled a backpack with a change of clothes and all the money I had, which came to $78. I still had some from Sonya, and I'd never spent the cash Whitey paid me for the week I'd worked. He overpaid me, maybe to try and keep my mouth shut. I took a jacket, because I was still waiting for Cappy, and because in spite of what I'd done, I was still the kind of person who thought ahead and made lunch. I put together a dozen peanut butter pickle sandwiches. I ate one and drank some milk. He still did not come. I remembered how hard it was to start Randall's car. "Engage," I thought. Pearl followed me around. I went into my father's office. I tried the desk drawer my father had been locking for a while now, and it caught. But he hadn't quite turned the key all the way, and I jiggled it open. In the drawer was a manila file folder. It was filled with greasy Xeroxes. There was the copy of a tribal enrollment form. On the form it said Mela Wolfskin. She was listed as 17 years old and the mother of a child named Tanya. Curtis W. Yelto was listed as the father, just as Linda had said. I closed the file and put it back in the drawer. I managed to turn the lock with a paperclip, so it would seem that the drawer had not been opened. What that mattered anyway, I don't know. I was glad that I wouldn't have to talk to Bierke. I took a sheet of writing paper from a leather box. My father kept a couple of sharpened pencils on his desk. I took one and wrote my parents that I was going on a camping trip. They should not worry. I'd be with Cappy, and I was sorry for the short notice. I said that we'd be gone for 3 or 4 days. I'd call them. I imagined writing, ask Bugger Poirier about his dream. But I didn't. There was some noise outside. Pearl barked. It was Angus and Zack. They wanted to know why we'd ditched them, and so I told them about the letter and about how Cappy was going to get Randall's car. "I've got something," Angus said. He showed me an ID. It was a driver's license, which his cousin had pretended to lose and got another one. He'd sold the ID to Angus, although the picture didn't look like him at all. "Don't you think it looks like Cappy, though? He could buy for us." "It looks like him enough," I said. Right about then, Cappy drove up, and we all got into the idling car. I sat in front, and Zack and Angus took the back. "Where are we going?" asked Zack. "Montana," Cappy said. The two in the back laughed, but I looked out the window at Pearl. She wouldn't take her eyes off me. I know there's lots of world over and above Highway 5, but when you're driving on it, four boys in one car and it's so peaceful, so empty for mile after mile, when the radio station's cut out and there's just static and the sound of your voices, and when you put your arm out to rest it on the hood, it seems you are balanced, skimming along the rim of the universe. We had half a tank when we left home, and we filled it up again twice before we got across the line to Plentywood. We dropped down there and edged along the bottom of Fort Peck to Wolf Point. Cappy turned the wheel over to me, and we sat there idling outside a liquor store while he bought a fifth and a case and another fifth. Zack had brought his guitar. He sang Cry in Your Beer C&W one after the next, making us laugh every time. And we kept going. The talk passing this way and that, turning funny and then ridiculous, as Cappy made his plan to spring Zalia from her house at the return address in Helena, still far off. Zack and Angus got nervous at a gas station and called home. That's when Zack got his ear scorched off. He slunk back to the car, looked over at me, said, "Oops." We ate the sandwiches. We ate beef jerky. Spicy sausages, bags of chips, and cans of nuts from the gas stations.
We guzzled water at a rest stop and the car died. We had to push it to a downhill slope, take it out of gear, and jump in while it rolled. The engine turned over and we war-whooped. High and fine. Zack and Angus passed out in back, leaning on each other and snoring. Cap and I started talking and kept on driving west through the long dusk. The sun burned forever and stayed balanced on the horizon for an age, then flared red from below that dark line for another eternity. So it seemed that time stopped. We rolled effortlessly in a dream. I told Cappy about the file I found in my father's desk drawer. I told him everything on the enrollment form. I told him about the governor of South Dakota. "So that's where the money came from," he said. "For sure. She was one of those smart high school girls who get picked to bring coffee and file papers. Get their pictures in the news. Especially a pretty Indian with the governor's arm around her shoulder," LaRose told me. "Linda knew it, too. That's where Yelto got to her. And Lark. He kept the secret, but he was jealous. Thought he owned her. The governor gave her money to keep her mouth shut. Start a new life?" She put the cash in her little girl's doll to keep it safe. Safe from Lark. I told Cappy that I'd seen the doll's outfit in the car as it came out of the lake. That the doll must have floated out of that open window and washed onto the opposite shore. "After this, I think," said Cappy, "it will all come out. There's still that file with his name on it, so why not? She was jailbait, Mela." "You go down for sure," I said then. "But Yelto never did." The silence of wind around us, the car cutting through the night along the Milk River, where Mushum had once hunted, driven out farther and farther into the west, where Nanapush had seen buffalo straight back to the horizon, and then the next year not a single one. And after that, Mushum's family had turned back and taken land on the reservation. He'd met Nanapush there, and together they had built the roundhouse, the sleeping woman, the unkillable mother, the old lady buffalo. They'd built that place to keep their people together and to ask for mercy from the Creator, since justice was so sketchily applied on earth. Hinsdale went by. Sleeping Buffalo, too. Malta. We'd turned south far ahead at Haver. We'd traced our route on the gas station map. "Let's keep going," said Cappy. "I feel good. Let's drive all night." "Make it so." We laughed, and Cappy slowed the car down and idled it while I ran around the front end, jumped in, and started driving. The air was cool and green with sage. The lights hit coyote eyes slipping along the ditches, in and out of fence lines. Cappy balled up my jacket under his head, leaned on the window, and slept. I kept driving on until at last I got tired and switched off again with Cappy. This time, Zack and Angus climbed in front to keep Cappy awake. I crawled him back. There was an old horse blanket that smelled of dust. I laid my head down and put the belt on because the buckle was cutting into my hip. As I dozed back there, listening to the three up in the front talk and laugh, I had that same drifting sense of peace I got in my parents' car. The guys passed the bottle back and I drank deep to put myself out. I slipped away easily. I slept without dreaming, even as the car hurtled off the road, flipped, rolled, threw its doors wide, and came to rest in an unplowed field. I had the sense of a vast and violent motion. Before I could grasp its significance, all was still. I nearly fell back asleep, thinking we had stopped. But I opened my eyes just to see where we were, and the air was black. I called for Cappy, but there was no answer. There was the distant sound of distress, not weeping, but a laborious panting. I unbuckled myself and crept out the open door. The sounds came from Zack and Angus, tangled together, moving on the ground, then staggering up and falling. My brain clicked on. I searched the car, empty. One headlight flickered.
I climbed out and made a widening circle around the car, but Cappy seemed to have vanished. He left for help, I thought in relief, as I stepped along slowly. There was only the light of stars, and the car's one beam. Parts of the ground were so black they were like pits reaching down into the earth. For one disoriented moment, I thought I stood at the entrance to a mine shaft, and I feared that Cappy had been flung in. But it was only shadow, the deepest shadow I have ever known. I went down on my hands and knees and crawled into the shadow. I felt my way through invisible grass. The wind came up and blew my friend's cries away from me. The sounds I made, too, when I found Cappy, were taken into the boom of air. I sat in the police station attached to the chair. Zack and Angus were in the Haver Hospital. They'd taken Cappy someplace else to fix him up for Doe and Randall. The ghost had brought me here. I'd seen him in the field as I held Cappy. My ghost had bent over me, backlit by the flashlight he held cocked over his shoulder, silver haloed, looking at me with a sour contempt. He shook me lightly. His lips had moved, but the only words I could make out were, "Let go," and I would not. I slept and woke in the chair. I must have eaten, drunk water, too. None of it do I remember, except that again and again I looked at the round black stone that Cappy had given me, a thunderbird egg. And there was that moment when my mother and father walked in the door disguised as old people. I thought the miles in the car had bent them, dulled their eyes, even grayed and whitened their hair and caused their hands and voices to tremble. At the same time, I found as I rose from the chair, I'd gotten old along with them. I was broken and fragile. My shoes were lost in the accident. I walked between them, stumbled. My mother took my hand. When we got to the car, she opened the back door and crawled in. There was a pillow in the same old quilt. I sat in the front with my father. He started the engine. We pulled out just like that and started driving home. In all those miles and all those hours, and all that air rushing by and sky coming at us, blending into the next horizon, then the one after that. And all that time there was nothing to be said. I cannot remember speaking, and I cannot remember my mother or my father speaking. I knew that they knew everything. The sentence was to endure. Nobody shed tears and there was no anger. My mother or my father drove, gripping the wheel with neutral concentration. I don't remember that they even looked at me, or I at them, after the shock of that first moment when we all realized we were old. I do remember, though, the familiar sight of the roadside cafe just before we would cross the reservation line. On every one of my childhood trips, that place was always a stop for ice cream, coffee and a newspaper, pie. It was always what my father called the last leg of the journey. But we did not stop this time. We passed over in a sweep of sorrow that would persist into our small forever. We just kept going. This is Gary Farmer. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Roundhouse by Louise Erdrich. This program was directed by Linda Korn and produced by Common Mode. Paul Falwood, Technical Director. It was recorded at the media staff and was engineered by John Kabarek. Executive Producer, Karen Chikonsky. Text copyright 2012 by Louise Erdrich. Production copyright 2012 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.